The title of my talk in the on the paper sounded very practical, but maybe it is practical, the question I'm asking. But I think there are also some fundamental aspects that hopefully are appreciated by the people here at this very nice conference. So what I'm going to tell you about is related to three papers that I've written with Sergey Bravyu and a few other co-authors. And the last paper, we're still finishing up. It will be out on the archive in a few weeks. Okay, so very briefly, I want to say something about what is my motivation, which is making a quantum computer in some sense, and then we simplify this a little bit and say, well, how we make a quantum memory. So I want to discuss the very briefly what are the approaches to making quantum memory, and can we come up with something better? And then a little bit of an overview about what we know about topological order at non-zero temperature. And then introduce a new model that I think actually has been considered informally by other people in the past. Not in the 70s, I think, but I mean, everything, you know, maybe has already been done in the 70s. But actually, Claudio Jamón said that he had also looked at this model, found some similar conclusions, but we have a little bit to add to that. So that will be the latter part of my talk.
Who discovered it first, but who discovered it last?
Okay, well, this is a new... In some sense, also, I think, for these gauge theories, it's a new context in which they become relevant or interesting. So that has value in itself. Okay, so I actually, there's sort of, I can identify two approaches to building a quantum computer, two communities that have been working on it. And this third column is sort of an imaginary community that I want to discuss. So the first approach is what I call the Lego approach. So this is the idea that we could, of a fault-tolerant quantum computer. Yeah, so we say to the experimentalist, first just try to make qubits that have very long coherence times that you can couple together via a set of universal gates, and that you potentially can make a lot of them. And then we'll give you quantum error correction codes that you'll be implementing, and most of the computation will be actually doing error correction. And then you, if you are below the noise threshold of these codes, which the best noise threshold are an error rate of 10 to minus 3 per gate, then these codes will allow you to get a logical error. So if you encode your information in logical qubits, the error on those qubits will be arbitrarily low, depending on what the overhead you're willing to spend, sort of. Okay, so what are the features of this model? Well, error correction is pervasive, as I said. There's a noise threshold that I don't think I'm actually showing this. Okay, no, I skipped this. So where are we with respect to this noise threshold? Well, we are at least an order 10 below the noise threshold, above, what am I saying? So we are a factor 10 away from the noise threshold in terms of the error rate. It's like 10 to minus 2 or higher. So you can ask about what kind of dimensional, is there any restrictions on where I have to put my qubits? Now, what is nice is that the current best schemes imagine a two-dimensional array of qubits. So that's like, you know, we don't have to go to zero dimensions to do this kind of computation. But there is going to be extensive I/O input-output for error correction, because you have to do error correction all the time, which means that you have to measure qubits or measure ancillary qubits, determine their state, and process that state to determine where the errors are. Have occurred, and then correct them. And so what drawback or engineering challenges this proposes is that, well, you have to be below threshold. You need fast classical decoding, which means that you need to process this error information quickly. And in some sense, also, this constant interaction of the quantum register with the classical world may have disadvantages in the sense that sometimes doing a measurement is actually fairly slow because somehow this small signal of a single spin has to be amplified to the classical world. Okay, so then there's the second strand, which would you say a more of a physics approach that was, of course, first championed by Kiteyev, is that let's forget about the error correction. We are going to encode our information in a low-lying eigenspace, a ground space, or a protected, you know, excited space with anions, and we are protected by a gap. That's to say, if we're at low enough temperature, the probability for errors will be very, very small. Yeah, so that also is happening in a 2D system. What is the drawback here in some sense? Well, it is a little bit of an all or nothing approach. We have to find, we have to get, you know, try to find this quantum Hall system with the right kind of anions that will do the job, and then it also has to, the gap has to be large enough, or we have to be able to control the temperature of the system. The material has to be pure enough. In some sense, both of these approaches, of course, are issues, the obstacles are issues of material sciences and purity of materials. One thing that this has, which that this doesn't have, is that the error rate is in some sense fixed. You are, if you are, have, you have limits on how push far you can push the temperature in the gap, that's what your system will give you. It doesn't have the flexibility as the first strand. Okay, so now let's dream about something new, like why would we not have finite temperature topological quantum order? So the idea is that, so here you're limited by the gap, but you can say, well, there may be other reasons why errors don't accumulate, why excitations, thermal anions don't accumulate. You would like a mechanism, because in principle you say, okay, you're protected by a gap, but once excitations happen, they can do bad stuff to your computation. But if you have a mechanism for these errors, for these fluctuations that you don't want to grow and to disturb your computation, you need some extra mechanism. And so the idea is that you would have some kind of system, and I'll discuss this more, so just a sketch, in which you can actually make the error rate arbitrarily small at low enough temperature, below some critical temperature. And so actually the error rate would get smaller if the system gets larger, which is in some sense similar as the first strand, in which if you are willing to have a larger overhead to use larger code, you can actually get the error rate smaller. So the question is, can we do, what dimension do we need to go to in order to do this? The advantage is clearly that if we don't need to actively error correct, we do actually encode our information in an error correction code or in a topological state. We have a Hamiltonian, which would say the ground space in which we encode our information is a code space, and it has all the nice features of topological, you know, of topological stability. But we're not actively projecting the state into that space all the time. So the advantage is that we don't need to do active error correction all the time. So the basic question is, can we do this in low dimensions? Okay, so Wen talked about what does topological order mean or not mean, and I've also wondered about this, and coming a little bit from quantum information science, you say, well, let's just, you know, define it, and maybe then I define something that is more restrictive than it should be, but at least it's well defined. Huh? So I can say I can define topological order actually using what I call quantum error correction codes. So I can say I have a degenerate, I'd like topological order, I can only define properly, and that's maybe already a restriction, if I have a degenerate eigenspace. Huh? It could be a ground space, it could be an excited space. And the expectation value of any local operator is independent of where I'm in this ground space. Yeah, so that is just saying there will not be a local order parameter right off the bat. Yeah? But this is actually a very familiar condition for people working in quantum error correction codes. This is the condition for this ground space to be the code space. Right? Because actually for a quantum error correction code, and I'm restricting myself to codes that are defined on lattices, which means that I have a Hamiltonian defined on a lattice, and it has some degenerate ground space. And that ground space has the property that for any operator V that acts on less than d qubits, say, of this system, I have this property. That d defines the distance of the code. That's just simply how the distance of the code is defined. And it also implies that that there is an operator for distance, you know, for weight or that acts on d qubits. So for any operator that acts on less than d qubits, this is true. And then there is an operator at x1 d qubit, which actually does distinguish these states. Okay, so I'll come to that in a minute. So what does that give you right off the bat by these rigorous proofs by Brachy, Hastings, and Michalakis that were mentioned in the talk before and may have been proved already, you know, many times ago, many years ago in some form, is that the ground space degeneracy is exponentially insensitive to perturbations of the Hamiltonian. So that depends on this parameter D, which is good, of course, because if you would implement this Hamiltonian, you never implement exactly that Hamiltonian that you desire. But these perturbations, they will not split the degeneracy between these different states. So meaning that if you put information in these states, they will not they will not be phased, these encoded qubits. And of course, then when D grows with the system size, this is typically the case for the toric code, where D grows with L, with the linear size of the system, we get a zero temperature topological phase. So you can say there's a certain critical perturbation size, but below which we're in the zero temperature topological phase, and beyond which this ground space degeneracy really is not no longer insensitive. It really blows up. Okay, just a few words about I was here there's no logical order parameter. You say, well, what's the non-local? Why can't we talk about a non-local order parameter? Now, I'm going to define something which looks ugly, and this is maybe the problem. But in some sense, it's very analogous to if you take the 2D Ising model, how you would define the order parameter, which is the average magnetization for that model. Yeah, so let's imagine I have this ground space encoding a single qubit. So I have operators that distinguish the states in this ground space. It's just a representation of SU2. So there is a logical X, a logical Y, a logical Z, all anti-commuting. So there is an operator which indeed tells me whether I'm in the state plus or minus or zero. And for codes that I'm interested later in this talk, also in the Torah code, for example, these codes are called stabilizer codes. They're the simplest codes that you can come up with. These operators are simply products of Pauli operators. And so they have eigenvalue minus 1 or plus 1. Now, if you can say, well, let's be naive and say, well, this is my order parameter. Well, that's not a robust order parameter. Huh? So that the point is that this has an eigenvalue minus 1 or plus 1, but actually a single error on the state. Or if I would make that state in this ground space plus the superposition of a single error somewhere that anti-commutes with this operator, I can actually flip the sign of this operator. And so you can define an error-corrected logical operator. So if you have a stabilizer code and you know how to do error correction for it, you can define an error-corrected logical operator. Now, I can give a definition of this operator, which is a kind of a prescription how you would define it. It doesn't look so nice, but what do you do when you do error correction? Is that it's basically, so if you have a stabilizer code, your ground space is the plus one eigenspace of all the terms in the Hamiltonian. And imagine that you would measure all of these, and some of them are minus one. This is called determining the error syndrome. It's actually, in other language, finding where the excitations are. And then let's assume that you can annihilate these excitations and then measure the C. Now, that whole procedure can be captured in an observable, which is the error-corrected logical observable. Anyhow, maybe I shouldn't go into this much more. I believe that this would have, if I would start, let's say, in the logical zero state of the Torah code, that's zero perturbation. Huh? So that eigenvalue of this is then one. And I would, look at how that state, that ground state, changes when I perturb the Hamiltonian. It's a gap system, so it's still saying the same. Then I think that this has a stable value. It would still stay, it will continue to be one in this topological phase. And in some sense, this is the same as taking the average magnetization. To say that the single site magnetization, If I take the 2D icing model, of course now we're talking about a finite temperature phase transition and not something where I have sort of virtual excitations, which are just, you know, superpositions but above the unperturbed ground state. If I talk about if I want to capture the memory phase of a 2D Ising model below the critical temperature, the average magnetization is a stable quantity, right? Because I'm actually doing error correction by taking the majority votes of all the spins, whereas a single site magnetization, which is good if the model is at zero temperature and really all the spins are aligned, is not good if I have these little error excitations, right? So you can imagine that for the 2D Ising model below the critical temperature, I just have little islands of errors, and if I do error correction, I basically filter out this effect. Okay, so so now let's discuss about what happens with topological order at zero temperature, at non-zero temperature. Okay, so we have a topically ordered ground space, degenerate ground space, and there is this exponential suppressing of dephasing between these states in the ground space. We assume now that Hamiltonian has a constant gap, which is natural for the stabilizer coefficients and string net Levin-Wen models. What happens with this parameter that I defined at non-zero temperature, this order parameter? So I can imagine, and I can actually calculate this for stabilizer codes. I prepare my system n spins of this Torr code, say, in a logical state, in one of these states in this ground space. So the eigenvalue of this is just one. And I bring the system in contact with the heat bed at temperature T, and after some time, I measure this observable. Okay, so then the question is, how quickly does this, you know, observable decay? It was 1 at T0. It goes down with some exponential decay, you expect. And, you know, you can define the relaxation time. And non-surprisingly, this goes like this sort of Arrhenius law that I think Claudio referred to, that if the gap is large and the temperature is very low, then this relaxation time can be very, very long. Now, note I have a 1 over n here. This is less a lower bound. But, of course, we actually do expect that this, if you only have a gap, that you have a behavior like that. Because the bigger the system is, the more opportunity there is for thermal excitations here and there. So what you see is that in the thermo, we define a phase always in the thermodynamic limit, right? So if you go to the thermodynamic limit, which may not be the practical limit that you're in, but in the thermodynamic limit, you see from this thing that I haven't proved, but I would expect, that you need to go to lower and lower temperature to preserve this memory. That's to say, if I put, you know, if I prepare a state in this logical zero state, I want to keep it there as long as possible. But in fact, I need to go, if I want to make the system large because I want to get good topological order, I would also need to go to lower and lower temperature. And the important thing is that this having a gap, of course, doesn't capture the distinction between a 1D and 2D Ising model, as everybody knows. Right? The 1D Ising model has a critical temperature at T0, doesn't have a memory phase, a finite temperature memory phase, whereas the 2D Ising model does have that. And why this is so? Well, this depends not just if there being a gap, it depends on the spectrum of excitations. And so the point is that in the 2D Ising models, you can say, if I want to go from the state with all spins up to the state with all spins down, what do I have to do? In fact, I have to go through states where I have, which cost me an energy with scales with the system size. Right? I have to create a domain wall in order to go through in order to make that transition. And this is what keeps this state ordered. There is a mechanism built in that I'm in the zero state, I have excitations, but I keep falling back and I don't never climb over this energy barrier towards into the valley of the logical one. Okay, so you can ask the same question, which many people have done. How about the generic model for topological order in two dimensions? Okay, so the surface code, we've seen that, so there's the Plaquette and Star operators. In terms of a distance, the distance is L, which means that any operator acting on fewer than L qubit doesn't see the difference between, you know, states in the ground space. Okay, so essential about the two-dimensional surface code is that these logical operators, which actually do map states in the ground state onto each other, these are non-local, they are string-like. And that has an immediate effect that there are actually or only order one energy barriers. So this is a depiction of this, although in real life you wouldn't expect this to happen. In real life, you have a little gas of excitations, right? Errors, say Z errors on sites, random sites here at some non-zero temperature. And what you see, what that happens, so what is the energy of such an excitation? Well, the energy depends on where it anti-commutes with one of these operators in the model. It anti-commutes here on the boundaries. So you have little strings. So this string can actually grow without costing more energy. So this string can basically oscillate freely. And so you have a gas of freely oscillating strings that can pair up and form longer strings and then create a string like this or a string like, you know, this. Okay. So and this is how this topological order, that's to say, I'm in the logical zero state, and I have this gas of excitation that is happening, and before I know, I will be in the logical one state, because those excitations will have combined to create the logical operator. Okay, so this has been studied by various people that are showing that if you pick a non-zero temperature and you go to the thermodynamic limit, you lose your topological order. Yeah, so that's so. Of course, if you have finite temperature, that is a finite system size. This is not necessarily an issue. Okay, so in this sense, it's a fundamental issue. It may not be an issue of like topological quantum computation is never going to work. That is, I think, not the message here. Okay, so people have looked. So I think this was first mentioned fairly clearly in a paper by Dennis Kiteev, Landahl, and Preskill. So people have looked at higher dimensional versions of the toric or surface code. And non surprisingly, these are, of course, all Z2 gauge theory. This theory actually in three dimensions was studied by Wegener in 71. So Wegener studied a model with plaquette operators. This is their commuting operators. And he showed that, okay, this doesn't have a local order parameter, and you can map it onto a 3D Ising model, and it has a non-zero critical temperature. Okay, let me just bring them all up. Okay. So what happens, so for the 2D model, there's sort of a duality between the different types of operators, between what we call the X stabilizers, the terms which are the star operators, and the Z stabilizers, the plaquette operators, and both logical operators are strings. Now what happens in 3D is that you have a six-body operator, which can also be viewed as the gate symmetry of this model, actually. But you have a six-body star operator with X's, all of these qubits that live on the links. And you can say, can I construct Z-like excitations that are like strings, that only anti-commute with stuff at the boundary? And you can, because you could just pick a string that goes all the way to straight and commutes with everything it passes by, and it only pays the energy at the boundary. On the other hand, the plaquette operators, because you take these plaquette operators in all the three different planes, if you can look at what kind of excitations you can create there, and you can see that all the excitations need to be membrane. So you can make a group, you know, you can make a cluster of errors, and then you can say, so what energy does that cluster cost? And that's the boundary of the cluster. Yeah? And that behavior is also studied, I think, by Wegener as a difference in a perimeter and an area law of below and above the phase transition. There's some characterization like that. But, you know, the point is here, not that we can take results from gates here and say, hey, that's useful here. No, actually not. Because we want, for our quantum memory, we want membrane-like errors with, you know, where the energy scales with the perimeter in both, for both these things. Yeah, so that you can actually achieve in four dimensions. Yeah, so in terms of the So in terms of the distance, so I'm not going to say what that is because it's, well, it's just a natural generalization of these models to the fourth dimension. But the point is that the three-dimensional surface codes in my language of error correction codes has distance scaling like L. It's an L by L by L lattice. Why it has distance scaling like L? Because the logical Z operator is a string. The logical X operator is a membrane. These are two anti-commuting operators of the logical qubit. So one is good in terms of this thermal stability. The other one is bad. The 4D surface codes has logical operators which are all membrane. So in fact, you can show, so this was noted by Dennis Kitaev, Landau, and Preskill, but there was also an explicit calculation. You know, you take that 4D model, you bring it into contact with a heat bath, and then you can prove that the relaxation time scales increases with system size. It scales like an exponent of something, a function to the L divided by poly L, doesn't matter, below a certain critical temperature. So that's like maybe too good to be true. Because then actually the stability of the memory increases. But of course this is what you have in the 2D Ising model. So why, yeah. But okay, so what is the problem here? Is that there's a fundamental difference between preserving classical and quantum information. For quantum information, we need to worry about two types of errors, X and Z errors. For classical information, we also only need to worry about bit flip errors. And this gets reflected into basically needing to go to higher dimensions if we want to create state of a memory in this sort of passive way without error correction. Okay, so the question we have asked ourselves, okay, so the 3D surface code has some good features, but can we, is there a no-go theorem here? Is there something that is really fundamentally not possible? Okay, so we've done some work for stabilizer codes in two-dimensional model proving that the logical operators are always string-like. Yeah, there always are string-like logical operators. And that, I think, is very strong evidence that, indeed, their topological order is lost at non-zero temperature for any 2D model. Of course, it only hopes for stabilizer codes, but it's a strong indication, and they're, you can probably generalize these things, but it then becomes very technical, maybe. Okay, so I think the fundamental question for 3D models is that we first thought, with, I think, a lot of people, that, well, there must be some kind of duality, and I've also seen this. If one of the logic operators is membrane-like, then the other one must be string-like or point-like. Yeah? So is this really true? Can we prove this? Well, what I'll show you with the spin model that I'll discuss now is that the question is a bit more subtle. We find we have a model with qubits where actually two qubits, all of the logical operators are membrane-like logical operators. Now, it doesn't actually solve the thermal stability question because, well, I'll come to that. So it's not like, you know, we hit the jackpot with this model. No, I still believe that I think there's a no-go result for three-dimensional quantum memory in this sense. But this is a very curious model, and we also get some monopoles, which are endpoints of membranes, which I'll discuss. Okay, so what is the model? So I said at the beginning, Claudio Camone also has discussed this model. Okay, so it's actually the most, I think it's one of the simplest extensions that you can come up with, which extends the Torah code to three dimensions. So the black dots are qubits, and the open dots are the centers of terms in the Hamiltonian. And so, for example, in the middle of this cell, I have the operator centered here, but it acts like Pauli X here in the two planes, and Pauli Y is here, and Pauli Z is there, right? So it's just, X, X, Y, Y, Z, Z. Okay, that's the action. So it's a six-body operator, and it has eigenvalue minus 1 or plus 1. It's just the product of polys. I don't care so much about the blue. The blue lines, they're face diagonals, and the green lines are body diagonals. Some of the restraints that will identify in this theory will be related to those. These terms in Hamiltonian are sometimes called stabilizer generators because they generate the an abelian subgroup, which is a stabilizer group characterized in the error correction code. Okay, so what can we prove about this model? Well, we put this lattice on a three torus, so we have closed boundary conditions in all directions, and so the directions are Lx, Ly, and Lz, and because in order to properly close this, we need to take Lx, Ly, and Lz two times some integers, and these are not necessarily all the same. And so this is a bit, okay, so what can we show? So you can define a Hamiltonian, which is the sum over these terms with a minus sign, such that, you know, they're all commuting, so when they all have plus one eigenvalue, you get the ground space. Yeah, so then you can look at what is the ground space degeneracy. Now, that turns out maybe to be a bit funny or intuitive, because it doesn't depend on the topology. Yeah, so usually you say, well, the Torah code on the, you know, on the torus has more degeneracy than on a sphere. So, but in this model it's slightly different, although I have to say, okay, so the degeneracy depends on the greatest common divisors of these three dimensions. So we will focus on mutually co-prime and odd numbers so that we have, quote, the least number of qubits. Now, I want to make one comment. You can prove for this model that it does have this exponential insensitivity to perturbations. And it, you know, of course it has a gap, and the gap doesn't close on these perturbations. So it really does have topological order in this sense. We do feel, however, that because the ground space degeneracy depends on this, the way these lattice dimensions. It's more the more fundamental features of the model are the excitations. And so what happens with these models, you have excitations like strings, and then the idea is when these strings close, then they become logical operators, right? When if you have the Torah code, you have a pair of excitations, and they wind around the torus, and they become a logical operator. Okay, but so we are also interested in the distance of this code and whether these logical operators are membrane-like, and that's why we want to choose the least number of. Okay, so how much time do I have? Let's see. 6 minutes, yeah. I know this is going to be tight. Okay, so with the, let me try to give you basically a little bit of ideas. I think it gets too technical otherwise. So I can divide the lattice in which the qubit lives in four sublattices, characterized by the parity of these lattices, parity of their coordinates. These are disjoint lattices. On each lattice, I can define three logical operators, an x operator, a y operator, a z operator, and these are mutually anti-commuting. So these four sublattices label four qubits. Yeah? And what are these operators? Well, they're half-filled planes. So, for example, if I have the z direction perpendicular to the slide here, then I put z operators in all of these. And this is an operator that I claim commutes with the whole Hamiltonian. And then similarly, I can have an operator that is orthogonal in the plane orthogonal to the x direction, and I half fill that with x operators. Okay? So those are the logical operators. You say, okay, I'm done. These are the membrane operators. But you know, this is the subtlety of these models. We are not sure that, you know, you can, these are operators that commute with Hamiltonian, but perhaps, and they're membrane-like, but perhaps they can be multiplied by elements SU, which act trivially on the ground space. So to reduce their support and make them string-like. Yeah, this is a non-trivial optimization. In some sense, you know, this is like the action of a gauge element, and it doesn't matter, you know, so I can't conclude from this that this is a membrane operator. Okay, so now I have to look at this. So actually this theory has a lot of strings, and there are two types of strings. One is a rigid string. So I can make a string. So again, I'm orthogonal to the z direction, and I put z's here. And then I have these terms in Hamiltonian, they will not be satisfied. So I have two defects here. I call this a dipole, and that a dipole. And these strings are rigid. That's to say, I cannot take turns without paying an NLT penalty. So if this string goes around the corner, I'll have a defect at the corner, actually a pair of defects. And actually on the plane, in plane terms, this is a double one, in the Hamiltonian, they act as the toric code. So I haven't said this very much. But then, of course, also operators coming above and below the plane, they act as signal Z operators, and they enforce this rigidity of the strings. Okay, so what can I do with a rigid string? How can I close it? Well, I can keep walking around, and I have to wind it around because this has periodic boundary condition. Now you see, if these lattice dimensions are incommensurate, I'll fill up the plane. So I have a fully filled membrane operator, which is quite not, is a product of these half-filled membranes operator. They're just, but I can also close. Okay, so this is the closed string in the plane. I can also close a string in three dimensions. And this is a weird object. Yeah, because what I can actually do, if I say, well, I don't want to, I'm in this plane with x's, and I want to get out of the plane, I want to go in this direction, I can only go on a diagonal, so I have to go this way, or I have to go that way with the green z's. But now I actually also, in order to not create a defect here, I have to also go in these directions. So the string branches. And then you also see that there are not that many choices of closing this object. I would like to have an object. This is an object that commutes with the Hamiltonian. Actually, you can write it. You can write it as the product of stabilizer operators in its interior. Just like in the toric code, you can take a ring, like an X loop, and write it as products of star X operators in its interior. But in two-dimensional toric code, you get a ring that you fill up with a plane-like thing. And here you get a three-dimensional object, but what is the support of this three-dimensional object? It's one-dimensional. It's only supported on these edges. It doesn't support these guys. So this is a trivially closed string, because now if you can tell me how to close rigid strings in three dimensions non-trivially, pick up something, then my conjecture will be false. So we have a conjecture that this code has qubits with membrane-like operators. And this relates to the fact that I don't know if I take a string that is such constraint and I need to close it, I'm in a three-dimensional space, I need to close it in a non-trivial way that has to pick up some of the topology. I can't do this with a three-dimensional object, right? I mean, I don't know how to do it, so. Okay, now, turns out there are other strings. They're associated with these planes, 1-1-1 planes, that, like, for example, I'm starting at the red qubit, we're red stabilizer, and then I touch on these qubits that are in the screen layer. You can define strings there, and they're actually there in the bilayer, they're in two layers of qubits, so we actually flatten the lattice on these bilayers, and they're flexible. Now, if I close these strings non-trivially, I get a logical operator. So I had originally defined these half-filled membrane operators. Turns out some products of these are actually equivalent to non-trivially closed flexible strings. So they are string-like. So I have to be careful because I want to find stuff that's only membrane-like. But I have to kind of take this out. Okay, so I'll just give you the claims. So we can find two good qubits. So we had four qubits encoded. We, by separating out these non-trivially closed flexible strings, we can actually define two good qubits for which all logical operators are membrane-like. So this violates the idea that if one logical operator is membrane-like, then the other logical operator must be string-like. We haven't actually proved this, but we strongly believe this. And then there are two other bad qubits which have this duality where one is membrane, the other one is string-like. Now, you can again ask, well, one of these logical operators, is this closed rigid string? So it's a string that keeps on winding around in a two-dimensional plane. So you say, well, okay, so now do I get thermal stability? Can I make this kind of object from going only through excitations that have order one energy barrier? Yes, actually you can, because you can imagine that you can make a lot of these, you know, excitations or cratings or these little rigid strings, and they vibrate freely, because they have no string tension, yeah, because it doesn't cost energy to extend them. And then they just team up over this two-dimensional plane, and they can fill up the whole plane this way. So in this model, we believe that these two good qubits, there is still no, they don't have finite temperature topological order. That's for sure. But this is my last slide, if you permit. Okay, we do have a very funny thing here. So I said these two, the rigid strings, they have, the endpoints are two defects. We call that a dipole. The flexible strings, which I flashed by very quickly, have endpoints that are four excitations, which we call a quadrupole. So you can ask, can I, what about a monopole, a single excitation? Can I create this locally, or what do I need to do to create this? Now, one thing about the Torah code is that the monopole is the endpoint. So the monopole has these string excitations, as Israel, I think, mentioned, and you can move these freely around. So the excitation of the endpoint of the string, what you call a monopole, it can be moved. Yeah. So it can be, it basically, you can say if it's isolated, it can be caused by an operator which is string-like. And we can actually prove in our model that if you have an isolated monopole, so single monopole and no excitations in an area around it, or let's say distance r away from it, then you have to, that monopole has to be caused by an operator which is membrane-like, which scales with the square of this distance. And this immediately gives that these monopoles are actually pinned. That's to say, there's no local operator that can move them, because if there's a local operator could move it, could it move to the boundary of this area, and that's the operator that causes it, basically. So we're trying to understand, what does that mean, that these monopoles, these isolated monopoles, that they take these membrane operators to happen. Now, actually, you can show that I can create this isolated monopole from the ground space by a path of errors, you know, each of which doesn't cost me more than order one energy. So it's not the energy barrier that is low, but it's a very specific sequence of errors. Yeah? So the idea is that if I would start with the ground space and I want to go to the Gibbs state, then that Gibbs state has a certain weight on this monopole sector. But I probably won't see any monopoles, because these are very hard to create. It's like, you know, there's a sort of an energy landscape, and there's a very small tunnel, there's a smelly small door. If I go through the door, I'll come to the, you know, I get a monopole, but it's very hard to find this door because, you know, you have random errors, and the, you know, the total number of paths, basically the total number of error sequences that create this monopole, is very low. So there's an entropic principle compared to the, you know, set of random errors. I'm not saying this very, you know, precisely mathematically, but we would like to study this model, I think, a little bit more detail to really see what happens. And we believe that if you take the thermodynamic limit, you basically never would see these monopoles, even though they are low-lying excitations. So this is what we get from studying the thermal stability question. We do get sort of a remnant of, you know, nothing that protects us for building a quantum memory, but some weird behavior. Okay.
So that's it?
Yeah. Questions? I do have a question.
Yeah.
So do you know this result by Ben Yoshida? So
yeah.
It seems to be claiming that in 3D, if you have a long property, this computer the one system, so how does it get around the hypothesis of the
model? Well, yeah, I think he first had something stronger that would also violate this, but I think he found there were some problems with his proof. So he's restricting himself to translation invariant and what he calls scale invariant system. So in some sense, he says the ground state space degeneracy shouldn't depend on the lattice dimension. And that is the case for our model. But but I think there is a theorem lurking there that says you always have string-like excitations. I'm almost sure that you always have string-like excitations in three dimensions. And then you can talk about how these flows or whatever, but you always will, you cannot just have memory-like excitation. That I'm almost sure.
Okay. you're saying that you expect to find the string in this model?
Well, we have found, that's the thing, we have these rigid strings and we have these flexible strings. But I think as a theorem you say, I think it's likely that for any three-dimensional stabilizer code, there are string-like excitations.
It's complementary to the number.
Of course, if it's string-like excitation, you can say, how do I close them? Now, I can close them, this model shows I can close them, make a membrane out of this, but it doesn't solve the thermal stability question. So, I think string-like excitation shows that you always have a problem with thermal stability, and then you don't care about the membrane-like operators, you know.
No more questions? So let's thank the speaker.